I'm Peggy Waymire. This week, the World Vision Report goes back to school.
Camel, cow, sheep, buffalo.
In India, Slumdog Scholars. Kids in Delhi go to school in a bus.
Many parents in the slums would not allow their children to go to government schools, either because they needed the money and they wanted their children to work, or at times also because they did not want to send their children far away.
In Kenya, girls drop out of school because they have no pads. Not notepads, but sanitary pads. Now there's help. And remembering a favorite teacher in Argentina.
El profesor Marcelo Kurz, he had me understand there is a world of knowledge inside a flower's reproductive system, inside a human heart, inside an opera house.
That and a lot more, but first this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Those are crowds in the streets of Nairobi last week, celebrating Kenya's new constitution. The old constitution was written by Kenya's former colonial masters in Britain, so the change has been long in coming.
This is the first time that people in this country can get a document which is of Kenyans, by Kenyans, and for Kenyans.
That's Ernest Waititu. He's a freelance journalist in Kenya, and he's here to tell us what this new constitution means for his country. Thank you for joining us, Ernest.
Thank you for having me.
Ernest, some people are calling this new constitution the heralding of a rebirth of a nation. What is it about the constitution that's so significant?
For so many years, this country, Kenya, has made very many attempts to take off as a democracy, as a country where there's rule of law. But that has never happened yet because I think the people vested hope and faith so much on individuals. So when the constitution came, this provided hope because it's not about an individual. It's about laying down a framework for governance in the country. And that is why people in this country are so excited, and they think that with all the problems that we have had in the past, the country can start all over again.
I'd like to talk a little about some of the specifics that the Constitution outlines, some of this framework you're talking about. And one of them is about diminishing the power of the president. So how will this Constitution limit the power of the president?
You know, the president in this country has always been, I would say, a king, because they would rule by decrees. They would decide sometimes who gets what position in the government, who gets land. Land was actually signed off by the president. But in the new constitution, presidents will no longer rule by decree. They will be checked by the parliament. There will also be a senate. And all these houses are going to check the president's powers.
One of the other important things about the Constitution is that it establishes Kenya's first ever Bill of Rights. And I'm particularly interested in what this means for women, new rights for women. Can you outline that for us?
This is a very pro-women document. For the last 47 years of independence in this country, women have been marginalized severely. They actually have been second-rate citizens in this country.
How so?
Women were regarded as property in the sense that if the husband died, in a number of communities in this country, the woman would actually be inherited by the brothers of the husband. And not just that, the property belonged to a man. And if that man died, the property still reverted to the family of the man. And that is a big thing that is going to change with this new constitution. Women are going to have better inheritance rights, or they're going to be empowered to inherit from their husbands.
I see. I want to tackle one of the other areas that the Constitution addresses, and that is land ownership, which is a very big issue in Kenya.
Yes, right from independence, land was owned by the colonialists, and when they left the country, the land was taken over by a few elite in this country. And over the years, there has been a lot of conflict over land in this country. Even the latest 2007 post-election violence was partly attributed to land.
Right.
So this constitution now is very clear about people who own a large tracts of land. The parliament is also going to set a limit on the maximum ownership of land. So that is very important, because people who have owned huge, huge tracts of land that they do not use are going to lose that land, and there is an effort to distribute that land among the people who are landless, and there are so many in this country.
Do you expect for this constitution really to make that much difference in the lives of Kenyans?
Yes, I do. Because to begin with, there will be decentralization of power. Beyond that is, of course, the distribution of resources across the country. For so many years, resources and services have been concentrated in Nairobi or other major cities in this country.
What basic services are we talking about here?
The best hospitals are in Nairobi. The best schools are in Nairobi. The best universities are in Nairobi. So with the new constitution, with the devolution of resources across the country, Kenyans have hope that hospitals, good hospitals, are going to be everywhere across the country. Good schools are going to be everywhere across the country. Good roads are going to be everywhere across the country.
It sounds, Ernest, like this constitution has been long in coming and that people have reason to be very hopeful and excited about what it might produce.
Yes, I can tell you that there are a lot of people who have shed blood, lost lives, maimed, injured in the struggle for a new constitution. So for many Kenyans, it is the realization of what they've been fighting for so many years.
Ernest Waititu is a freelance journalist from Kenya. He joined us from Nairobi. Ernest, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Peggy, for having me.
We'll have more from Kenya later in the show. All eyes remain on the U.S. economy as it wobbles toward recovery. The trade deficit appears to be part of the problem. You can see why. Just check the labels on your clothes or on that box of fish sticks in your freezer. Nearly 90% of what Americans consume comes from overseas. The products arrive in huge ships, which are manned by mariners. Around 1.2 million people work on these freighters. And while they're out to sea, the sailors have to be fed. Chris Burrell climbed aboard a container ship from Iceland and has this story from the ship's galley.
In a ship galley gleaming with stainless steel cabinets and countertops, Ronaldo Salcedo grabs hold of a long knife and slices up an onion with the rapid-fire wrist action of a pro.
I prepare around 8 pieces, two onion slices, put some garlic cloves, some vinegar, salt, pepper, and make it boiled. Easy prepare.
This one skillet full of striped mackerel may be a quick and easy meal, but Salcedo's job is anything but. He's the sole cook for 15 merchant seamen aboard a container ship that hauls tons of frozen seafood from Iceland to eastern Canada and the U.S. A round-trip voyage lasts 28 days, but Salcedo's been cooking on the Reykjafoss flat out without a single day off for 8 months now. A typical contract for a crew member requires a 10-month commitment, but Salcedo, who is Filipino, signed on for a full 12, all because he's got a rather simple dream: to be home for Christmas with his family.
14 years. No Christmas time, always on the ship. That's why my wife told me that please, even one time, come home to spend our Christmas with your child.
The extra 2 months of work will buy Salcedo that first ever holiday with his two boys back home in Manila. For now, though, that day is many meals and many miles away. What makes the work even harder is that Salcedo must cook one lunch for the all-Filipino crew, and then an entirely different meal for the officers, who are Icelanders and Ukrainians.
This is for the officers, pork chop steak. I need some olive oil, garlic, pepper, that's it.
Meanwhile, out on the deck of the Reykjafoss, a few of the men that Salcedo keeps well-fed are dressed in orange coveralls and send up hand signals to a crane operator who grabs hold of the ship's massive containers and swings them over to the dockside. When Filipino crew member Jonathan Salon learns what's on the lunch menu, his eyes grow big.
Yes, that's our best food in the Philippines, of fish, and that's a dish, a poor man's dish.
It isn't just his fellow Filipinos who get a taste of home when they eat Salcedo's cooking. He also knows how to cook a pot of borscht, a fact that makes the ship captain from Odessa, Ivan Glushikov, quite happy.
All things he's cooking is perfect, but for cooking, really, he's only one person. For 15 person on board, his cooking is quite difficult. He has a hard job.
As Salcedo drops French fries into the bubbling oil of a deep fryer, he points to the burn marks on his forearm. Cooking is especially dangerous when the ship rolls through high seas in the North Atlantic. But after all the cooking and the cleaning is done, Salcedo will take a break and hitch a ride to the local shopping mall.
Oh, I'm very happy. Everything is gone. Everything is free. Yeah.
He hopes to let someone else cook lunch for him at McDonald's, where he'll take out his laptop and email the family he misses so much. Maybe he'll remind them he'll be home for Christmas. For the World Vision Report, I'm Chris Burrell, aboard the Reykjafoss on the Mystic River in Everett, Massachusetts.
It's the beginning of September and the start of a new school year, and we're going to take this opportunity to look at schools in the developing world. It's not always easy to get to school or to stay in school if you're a kid in Africa or in Asia. For most children, school isn't a way to get to college. It's a pathway out of poverty. To start our special report, we're going to hear from one of our reporters in Argentina with a personal story about his own education.
My name is Marcos Federman. My favorite teacher is El Señor Marcelo Cursi. I had him since I was 13 until I was 18 years old. During my entire high school, I took many courses with him. Biology, music, photography, and even orchard. Those courses were different, but they all had in common one thing. The love for learning, the curiosity. Marcelo Cursi inspired me to love learning for learning itself. There's a lot to know just about anything. The truth is that Marcelo's classes could be of biology or music, but they were always about life. He was a curious and very warm man. He inspired respect because he treated you with respect. El profesor Marcelo Cursi had me understand there is a world of knowledge inside a flower's reproductive system, inside a human heart, inside an opera house. The first time I ever went to an opera house was with him. Thanks to him, I am amazed at how plants reproduce, grow, and move. Thanks to him, I took pictures of my orchard with a camera we built in his class. Marcelo Cursi planted the seed of curiosity inside me, and I am learning new things all the time since then.
Come with us as we go back to school this week. This is the World Vision Report, and I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Kids around the U.S. are wrapping up summer vacations and heading back to school. But children in other parts of the world don't always have that opportunity. Here's a staggering figure. More than 100 million children are not enrolled in school. Girls drop out more frequently and earlier than boys do. Sometimes it's because they have to work to earn money for the family, or they need to do chores around the house. But sometimes girls drop out for a reason that might surprise you. Here's Michael Kaloki, reporting from Nairobi, Kenya.
14-year-old Constantine Watenda lives in the Nairobi slum of Viwandani and is looking forward to going to secondary school. But she says when she has her period, she often must miss school because she doesn't have access to sanitary pads.
The pad is expensive. It cost 125 shillings. My mother has a problem because to our house, we are six children. She has spent the money to pay the school fees.
Constantine was among a group of students who received a donation of sanitary pads at an event sponsored by a Nairobi-based organization called the African Population and Health Research Center. She says many of her friends also experienced the same problem.
My friends started crying and said that they drop out to school.
we have noble intention to ensure that as many girls as possible continue with their education.
Bertha Juma Kokaj is with Sunnybank Consortium, another group that is trying to help poor girls unable to attend school because they lack sanitary pads.
We came together in order to have what we called a sustainable way of enabling these girls to access sanitary pads. What we do is that we raise funds from well-wishers, we raise funds from donors, we raise funds from individuals, and with those funds we are able to purchase sanitary pads.
It's difficult to estimate how many girls miss school or drop out entirely because they don't have pads. It appears that no studies have looked at the specific issue. But the issue has received a lot of press in Kenya. And recently, a number of other initiatives have been set up to provide pads to girls. Although these have helped, advocates say there still remains a challenge to ensure that the education of girls around the country is not disrupted by their lack of access to sanitary pads. For the World Vision Report, I am Michael Kaloki in Nairobi, Kenya.
That program to provide pads for girls took place in Kenya. Now we head to South Africa, where a similar project has been up and running for several years for girls in 7th to 9th grade. We wanted to find out how the girls in that project are faring, so we invited Dr. Paul Krumhout, the head of the program, onto the show to talk about it. Dr. Krumhout, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You've been working at this PADS program for a while now, and I'm wondering what kind of difference it's made in the lives of the girls your team is involved with.
It has been possibly one of the most exciting projects we've ever done. It has changed the lives for these girls in the most amazing way. It has built their confidence. It has enabled them to develop a vision of a future for themselves. And it has given them the tools with which to live and operate in their communities without feeling ashamed, without feeling worthless, and without feeling frightened of what's been happening to their bodies.
You know, it's really amazing because we take things like this for granted in our country. It's hard to believe that something like sanitary pads could change the lives of young girls in such a way. Are menstrual cycles something that are taboo to talk about in Africa for these girls, especially since they can't afford sanitary pads?
Yes, it would certainly seem so. There used to be a system called Izindonjane, which means the young swallows, which was a system for initiating girls into adulthood and becoming women. Among the Nguni group of people, or the Xhosa people, that was the way young girls were taught. That system has collapsed, unfortunately, in most of our societies, both urban and rural.
Why is that?
I think it's a disintegration with the impact of modernization and the whole world sort of turning topsy-turvy. What we faced with currently also is that many of the girls are now orphaned or have only one of the members of the family surviving.
Is that because of HIV/AIDS?
Yes, mainly through HIV/AIDS, because our prevalence rate is sitting at about 26%.
So there's really nobody there to teach or mentor these girls, you're saying?
No, not at all. And more than 75% of them have not got somebody that they've been able to talk to about the changes that their bodies are going through. They feel ashamed. They are frightened. One young girl told us that when she started her period, she was terrified that she was going to bleed to death because she didn't know that it would stop. So they had to face this thing totally alone.
So your organization goes into the schools, into the communities, and you do a lot more than give away sanitary pads, which these girls can't afford. Tell us a little bit about what your program tries to do with these girls.
Yes. So our program looks at, firstly, because we're wanting the program to be sustainable, teaching the teachers and the schools and providing them with the materials to provide puberty education to girls. And where we were coming from when we first got involved was that it was the high dropout rate of young girls. The highest rate of dropout for young girls in schools is in grade 9, and the second highest is in grade 7, which happens to bracket the period from where many young girls start becoming women and go through puberty. So what was happening was that many of these young girls were dropping out of school.
Yeah, and if they drop out of school, what do their futures look like?
Well, young girls who drop out of school at the age of 13, 14, 15, the likelihood of getting a job is zero because we've got a very high unemployment rate. And these young girls, they have no money. They often, most of them are from very poor families. And without the knowledge of even what's going on with their own bodies, what that leads to is pregnancy very quickly. Also, very good chance of catching sexually transmitted infections and HIV/AIDS. They are really unable to control what's happening to them because they're now becoming even more dependent now on either their parents or the males who have made them pregnant, and they're in a very disempowered position. So it's a deadly cycle.
It all is traced back to that, and because she's staying out of school, that's why she ends up dropping out? I mean, why does she have to drop out?
For at least 3 to 4 days a month, they're not attending school because of their periods. So that makes them, on a monthly basis, you can basically write off a week of each month, and the child falls further and further behind in schoolwork.
And then they get very discouraged, and they just finally give up, I guess.
Yes. These other issue is that at schools, unfortunately, in many of the poorer schools, the toilets are quite shocking. Those that do have restrooms don't have wash hand basins or any privacy. And if there are no restrooms at all, you can imagine the plight a girl is in.
This must be affecting, I'm assuming, millions of girls in impoverished parts of South Africa.
Absolutely.
How many girls has your program been able to reach in the last several years?
Since 2008, we've been able to reach 3,522 girls per year in 157 schools, which has been part of the piloting.
And then does the school provide the sanitary napkins?
What we've been able to do, with support from Procter & Gamble from the USA, in fact, and Save the Children UK, is to get sanitary pads for free to the girls, and that we are still continuing with. At the same time, we've now started the program teaching women to be able to make sanitary pads in rural sewing groups, to be able to make sanitary pads, and that's what we're aiming for as our next step, which in some cases for very poor families are more affordable.
I'm wondering, have you done any research on the statistics on exactly what kind of difference this has made in terms of dropout rates and girls going on into careers?
I did. In terms of the attendance at school, the percentage of girls who were absent for at least 2 to 3 days a month was in the order of 75%. We've now decreased absenteeism down to only 5%. The other result is that for the girls, we were finding a very high rate of teenage pregnancy at schools, between 10 and 12 girls per year. Since our program has started, the figure has dropped to 2 to 3 per year on average.
And that's because of the education.
Yes. So it's had an amazing impact. The program also provides possibly one of the best entry points for working on prevention of HIV and AIDS. And this also has a major impact.
Are you at all surprised at just how great a difference it's made?
I am astonished. I am blown away by how big an impact such a small change, such a simple thing, can make in the lives of so many girls. These girls are now confident. They're able to speak to their parents about what their problems are, what their needs are in terms of sanitary pads. I almost burst into tears when one of the fathers said that for the first time he's actually able to talk to his daughter. The mother had died, and he said, "I now know that my daughter needs these things, and I can now help her. And we can talk about what she's going to do in her future and a whole range of things."
Boy, that puts a smile on your face, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That from such small things, so much good can come.
Paul Krumhout, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Krumhout heads up the Protecting Futures Initiative in the Eastern Cape, South Africa. Sometimes the biggest barrier to educating children is finding a school to go to. There just aren't enough schools for everyone who needs one. That's true in the slums of India, where kids live far away from the nearest school. Now, a project in New Delhi is bringing school right to the students' doorsteps. Will Everett has the story.
Okola Mandi is a slum near central Delhi. The roads here are lined with deep ditches filled with foul water and rotten vegetables from the nearby produce market. Nothing could be more out of place than the bright yellow bus adorned with cartoon characters that sits on the side of the road.
Namaste.
It's about noon and the bus is packed with about 35 kids. There are no desks or chairs. The kids sit on the floor, anxious to get started. Some are clean and simply dressed. Others are dirty, barefoot, and in rags. They range in age from 7 to 14.
Animal names.
Today they're learning the names of animals in English. An 11-year-old girl named Sneha comes to the front and identifies the animals as her teacher points to them.
Camel, cow, sheep, buffalo, dog.
Sneha
horse,
dropped out of school last year. She's trying to catch up so she doesn't have to repeat a grade. But most of these kids have never stepped inside a school before, like 14-year-old Roxana. She heard about Chalta Firta, or mobile school, from one of her neighbors. After attending classes here for 6 months, she can now read in both Hindi and English. The thin girl rises, throws back her ragged scarf, and demonstrates what she's learned.
A, B, C, D, E.
For kids who can't get out of the slum to attend a regular school, this school comes to them. Each day the bus stops at four Delhi slums where the kids get 2 hours of accelerated courses in such basics as reading, math, and health.
This particular project began in partnership with the government.
That's Sujata Khanna. She's with the organization Butterflies, which manages the mobile learning project for the city of Delhi.
Because they realized that there was a problem of children not getting the education they deserved, and also that many parents or communities in the slums would not allow their children to go to government schools, either because they needed the money and they wanted their children to work, or at times also because they did not want to send their children far away.
The teachers on the bus don't stay on the bus. When students don't show up, the teachers will go to their homes and look for them. Sujata admits that this isn't always possible. In fact, Butterflies takes its name from the fact that many of their kids are homeless and prone to disappear.
Street children, they keep fluttering from one place to the other. They'll go wherever they wish. They come back after a month and we ask them, "You haven't been coming for classes. What happened?" "It was too hot in Delhi. I didn't want to stay here. Who wants to stay here?" So they keep moving from one place to the other.
Roxana isn't a street kid, but her family is extremely poor. She works 2 jobs as a domestic servant and makes about $20 a month. She works in the mornings and afternoons, with just enough time in between to come to the mobile school.
I wake up early in the morning to have tea and get ready for work. Then I go to my first job. At noon, I come here to go to school. When class is over, I eat some bread and I walk to my other job. It's about 2 kilometers away. It's a lot of work. I have to wash the dishes, mop the floors, do the laundry, and just keep the house clean.
She says going to school has changed her life. Now she can read street signs and count money. Today the students go through the multiplication tables. When it's Roxana's turn, she falters. This is still new to her. Only a few months ago, Roxana didn't know how to add and subtract. But attending the mobile school means more than just classwork. Sometimes the students get to watch movies on the big flat-screen monitor in back of the bus. one recent offering, Slumdog Millionaire. And they also get to sing, something Roxana loves to do. She blushes shyly as she sings a devotional song to Krishna. She says she's not considering a career in music. Her goals are more practical. I love studying, she says. I want to be somebody when I grow up. I think I'll be a teacher or maybe a nurse. Roxana's made rapid progress toward that end. With the help of butterflies, she's convinced her parents to let her quit her job. So she'll soon be enrolled in school for the first time. The program has helped get some 200 kids into public schools. And there are plans to increase the number of buses from 2 to 30. But all too soon, at 2 p.m., school is over at this stop. Roxana and the other kids say goodbye to their teachers, spreading out through the Oklahomandi slum. Some go home. Some, like Roxana, go back to work. Some will never come back. But for those who do, the mobile school will be waiting for them, with more exercises, more games, and for some, the promise of a better future. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Delhi, India.
We stay in India for this week's Globe at a Glance. Children in rural India love their school libraries. Most of them were built by an organization called Room to Read. But the group doesn't just build libraries, it also publishes books in local languages to fill those shelves. The school libraries close over the summer, but kids in India didn't want to lose those libraries even for just a few months. So they jumped at the chance to become librarians themselves. The Room to Read staff trained one student per village to take care of the library books in their homes over the summer. The young librarians also learned how to help other children develop a love for reading. One student traveled from door to door each morning with books in hand for neighborhood kids. She'd drop off the books in the morning and pick them up each afternoon. If the children couldn't read, they'd get the books anyway, just so they could learn how to handle them, to look at the pictures and explore the pages. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
My name is Jack Jackaman, a Christian Palestinian from Bethlehem. I'm a carver. I do carving religious items since 20 years ago. The best teacher that I met is my religious teacher. He is a priest, Jesuit Father Peter, who taught us about all religion, Christianity, Islam, and Jewish. So he is the best teacher that I met because till today, I am going back to what he said for us 30 years ago. He gave us a good experience how to live with others, and this is, you know, to respect others. And as much as we respected others, we were respected by people. And this is the best thing that he taught us, to love everybody. Because you are living in a place like in the Middle East, everywhere, every person is thinking in a religious way. So you know about his religious, you can deal with him. It's helped us to live here.
That note from Bethlehem was brought to us by reporter Daniel Estrin. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. And now on our education tour, we're going to talk to a PhD student named Kakenya Nteia. She's finishing up her doctorate in education at the University of Pittsburgh. But unlike most of the students there, Kakenya comes from a Maasai village in Kenya, where girls are not expected to finish their educations.
The expectations for the boy was that he would go to school and he would go to secondary school, he would get a job outside the home and be the, you know, the breadwinner for the family. The girls, we were going to school to socialize and to wait until we reach 12, 13 years old, reach of age of puberty. And then after that, you would get married and have children.
That's Kakenya Nteia. She's founder of the Kakenya Center for Excellence for Girls and a recipient of the recent National Geographic Prize for Emerging Explorers. Kakenya's story starts in the Maasai village where she grew up. She was betrothed to a boy in the village when she was just 5 years old. Her father mostly worked far away from home in the city. Her mother had only finished fourth grade, but she believed in education and encouraged Kakenya to continue hers. Kakenya graduated from eighth grade with top grades, but her father didn't want her to continue her education.
So I had to find ways of getting into high school. I went to the local high school, which everybody already knew me. So while I was in school, my father came back and he said that I shouldn't continue with school, but I should be mutilated. I should be cut or I should be circumcised so that I can get married.
Why did he tell you on one hand that he was proud of you and that he would take you to the city and then suddenly change his mind and say, no, you should be circumcised and get married and not finish school?
There was really a lot of pressure on him because already there was this agreement that I was going to marry this man. I'm only not just my father's daughter. I mean, the entire, like my uncles and anybody my father's age, they are my fathers. So they also decide. And so there was really a lot of pressure on him, and not just on him, but everybody who was related to me, they needed me to be married. And the thing about marriage is that there's an exchange of cows. When I get married, my father will get 7 cows, goats and blankets. And it's not just my father, it's also my uncles and my grandmothers. There's a lot of exchange of gifts that, well, there's not really exchange of gifts, but it's gift coming from the husband's home to my home. So,
right. And you're the oldest child. You're the oldest daughter. So your father was counting on this income from you.
So when he came back and said I was going to get married, that was really a difficult part for me. But I told my father that, you know, if he doesn't let me go back to school, I will run away, and the stigma behind the issue of not having a girl who is not cut will stick to him forever. And so that was my deal, is that I would get cut if he lets me go back to school. Otherwise, I was going to run away.
And he agreed to that.
Exactly. He did agree to that. I got cut and I went back to school.
It sounds as though for you to be cut or circumcised was more important to your father's dignity than for you to drop out of school and get married right away.
Exactly. There is no girl in the village who has ever stayed uncut. And for him to have, that title, that is the father of a girl who is uncut, it's a very shameful thing.
Can you help us understand that? Why is that so shameful for a father, for his girl not to be cut?
You know, since our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, this is a tradition that has always continued to take place in our community. And so they don't know anything else. But there's also the idea that a girl who is not cut, she's smelling. They have, I would call them stigma or ideas that are not really true. And the fact that it's told us that it's what makes you a real woman. And so for him to have a daughter who is called a woman is so important to him than a child.
What happened then? So you went on to a high school with boys, or were there other girls there as well?
So I went to a school that there were boys and girls, and it was the district level where we had girls from other tribes in the school. So,
how were you treated there?
It was a good experience for me, and it was really a good experience because I was learning with boys and I challenged the boys, and it was really, really a good experience in terms of working very hard and having goals that go beyond just being a mom, a mother at home.
Mm. It sounds from the way that you're talking that even though your mother worked hard and had to drop out of school early and had 8 children, she was really supportive of you taking a different path.
Exactly. My mother always told us that she never wanted us to have the life that she was living in. And the reason is that she went to school, but she dropped out of 4th grade. And she always told us that the guys or the boys who were with her in the same classroom were members of parliaments. They had big, banks, and they were heading big banks, and they were living very comfortably. And she said that it's an education that made them be that way. So if she had gotten an education, she would be where they are. But she was not. And she said that I was actually even smarter than most of those boys. And so she would tell us that that she was denied an education, but for us, we were not going to be denied that education, that she was going to work very hard and ensure that we got where she didn't get to.
She must have been very proud of you.
She is a very proud mom, and she's very proud of me even now, what I'm doing and where I am.
Yeah, tell us where you are now and what you're doing.
Wow, I'm still dreaming. When I was a child, I always wanted to be a teacher, which I really was exciting for me. Where I am now, I'm completing my doctorate at the University of Pittsburgh in education. I have started a girls' school in Kenya, and I'm a mother of one child, and I chose my own husband, and I am where I am. I'm where I want to be right now. So,
boy, you have really come a long way. You finished your high school in Kenya, and then you came to the United States for your higher education?
Yeah, I tell people from rural to global.
How did you do that? You must have been a real dreamer.
I am blessed in many ways that I don't take for granted where I am, and I do believe that. I pray a lot, and that helps me. And what happened is that when I finished my high school, there was a gentleman from my village who's been to the university in America, and I told him to help me come here. And he looked at me and said, "What?" He couldn't believe me because I had finished high school. The family that I was supposed to get married to, they were already coming to get me and to be married to them. But I was here wanting to disappear to another country in another world. But he did agree. He got me forms. I did apply and I got an opportunity to come here. Also, it was not just an easy thing as ABC, I got accepted to college, so get on the plane and go. My father was sick then. We didn't have enough money to even buy the air ticket to come here. And I needed the community to raise money to help me buy the ticket and get here. The men and the women, people in my community, they have never seen a girl leave my village to even go to the city, leave alone to go to another country. So they could not even imagine it. But I did persuade them. I used the traditions of going to the most elderly person in the village, and I said I needed his support. And he told me he couldn't do by himself, and he sent me to 16 other families, and I did get all the men on board and the women on board. They did collect money. They sent me to this country. But for me to come here, it was on a condition that I would go back and help them, help my community become a better community. So,
and let's talk about that. That's an amazing story. You did go back and help your community, even though now you're working on your PhD in the United States. You mentioned that you went back and started a school for girls. Can you tell us a little about that school you started?
Really, what happened when I arrived in the U.S., the whole world kind of opened up for me because there was so much information. I come from a community where there were the radios which were available were only used by men. So women and children, we never had access to the radio. There are no TVs, no running water, no electricity, and no newspapers. And the only books I read was like textbooks, and really didn't have any concept of what was the outside world like. And when I got in the United States, I got the opportunity to learn, to go to the internet, to research as many things as I could and learn about female genital cutting and learn about early marriages and learn about poverty and learn about so many things that I didn't have access to in Kenya. And that really started really, really making me feel like I have to make an impact. I have to go back to my community and help my community because I thought my community was being left behind. But what was more striking for me is whenever I went back to Kenya is to find young girls getting married, getting mutilated, and their dreams were being shattered. And, girls that we went to school with, they were really not looking any happy. They had children. Another one was pregnant, carrying another one in the back and another one on the hands. And it was really a hard life for them. And for me, my heart was crying of just wanting to take them away and just do something to really help them to be happy. And so I went back and talked to the people in the community about building a school for girls because I knew best that if I could give these girls an opportunity, I would ask myself, where would I make the most impact? And I remember my childhood. What would I, if I was, when I was young, what stage or what did I miss that I should have gotten? So I looked at that and looked at my life in primary school and said, you know, I didn't have the best life that I wanted to have in primary school. And if I did have the best life that I wanted to have in primary school, going to secondary school would have not been hard, or going to a university would not have been hard. And so we started a girls' school for girls ages 8 to 14 years old. Basically, it's 4th grade to 8th grade. And we take these girls from families that really are very traditional, families that have many children and they're not investing on the girls. Some of them, we have orphans, we have single parents. HIV is a big issue right now in the community. We really bring them to the school where they're cared for. We look at the teachers. We have small classrooms, so teachers are focusing on the child. You know, 30 students in one class, and really, really, really making a difference. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Now, Kakenya, when you say we, who started the school and how did you raise the money for it?
I say we because I have a whole village of people that are working with me. My village extends beyond the boundaries of Kenya. In Kenya, the village gave land where the school is being built. Our government is giving funding towards some of our buildings and teachers. And I have supporters from everywhere in the world, throughout the United States. I have supporters in England and anywhere you can think, China. People coming together to do good for the people, for the girl child, and it's a whole village. It's not just me. So.
Right, and the school I understand is in its second year now. You have about 60 girls there. How are they responding? What do you hear from them?
Oh my goodness! I wish I could show you pictures of the girls. How when we took them in the first time, they looked so quiet and they didn't even smile. They just looked like girls that their hopes were just going to end. Really, after a year, it's just unbelievable. The girls are happy, they are jumping, they are running, they're just being girls. And it's really, really exciting to see them smiling. I ask them what they want to be. You know, some of them want to be pilots, doctors, and lawyers. I just have a variety of very dynamic young girls that really see, you know, they have dreams, and seeing that our school is a place for them to really achieve their dreams.
Has the issue of genital cutting for young girls changed at all because of the school you've started and the experience that you went through?
There's so much that has changed. People are talking about the issue. They're not afraid. When we were going through the genital cutting, you're told never to talk about what happened to you or what is going to happen to you. But now, parents of the students that we have, they do have talks about genital cutting. We do host those things that talks about that. The men are speaking up and the women are speaking up. And it's been an amazing transformation to see people talking about it, and some even going to an extent of allowing their girls to stay uncut. Mm,
that must be quite an experience for you to look back in your village and you having been the only girl that got to do what you do, now to see all these other girls, 60 of them, really having life-changing experiences in school, what is that like for you?
It's my joy. It really, really makes me happy. I look at my country and I think about what country do I want to see 20 years from now. And I look beyond just my village and I think about where I would love my country to be, is that there should be no poverty in Kenya, and that, you know, we are a very wealthy country, but we are still poor. It does not make any sense. But if we could bring up young leaders, people who care about their own, people who care about making a difference and improving their country, that's what I see in these girls. And that's my hope, is that my future will be a better future than it is now. And it's going to come through because of the opportunities these girls are going to have and the impact that they're going to have. It's exciting.
Kakenya is the founder of an academy for girls in Kenya and the recent recipient of a National Geographic Emerging Explorer Award. Kakenya, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and we wish you the very best of luck with this school and your plans for the future with it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's where we leave you today. Remember, you can find us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Mali Senekelo, Ani Mani Monikelo.